My name is Tom Martin, and I'm a pastor currently at Nakoma, North Dakota, and a guest here at Holden Village. And it's good to be with you this afternoon to share a few things about my life and my journey with addiction. It's a journey I'm still on because I consider myself a recovering alcoholic. And it is a journey I expect to be on for the rest of my life. But it is not a journey without hope. And for that, I'm grateful. I'm grateful to be here today sober and able to share some of my recovery with you. As we think about addiction, it's a tough one to talk about. It's a tough thing even to look at, and it took me a long time to even say the word as a recovering person. And I think in Alcoholics Anonymous, the big book uses this description. For alcoholism, it says it is powerful, baffling, and cunning. And I have found that to be very true as I have lived with my alcoholism. Baffling, cunning, and powerful. And I've struggled with ways to try and understand what has happened to me in my life. That I became addicted to mood-altering drugs and alcohol. And as I've tried to make some sense of that, a few resources I found helpful are these two here. I'll Quit Tomorrow by Vern Johnson of the Johnson Institute in Minneapolis. And also a little paperback book called Love and Addiction by Peel. And what I'm going to do today with you is just share one way of trying to get some handles on how one becomes what addiction is all about. And one way I think we can grapple with that is to look at the process that we go through in terms of getting to know one another, of dating, of courting, of falling in love, of getting married, and finally divorce. Now, I don't know how well this will speak to you if you're single, but I think there are some ways we can understand this, and I'd like to share that with you. First of all, when I was in high school, I began to be attracted to drugs and alcohol. There was something there that caught my attention in the same way that when the man or the woman of our life comes into relationship, there's something there that attracts us, that gets our attention, that draws us together. And that's the way it is too with our drug of choice. And I'm just going to be talking about alcohol here, but that could be true for any drug. Certainly, alcohol is a drug, a very powerful drug. So when you start to be attracted to someone, then you start looking for ways to come back. And to make connections with that attraction, with that, and I suppose that's really my first point of contact here. And just as an aside, I put some statistics on the board here for a 1983 study that was done in Minnesota that talks about 8th graders and 12th graders and went in. And how many of them have used alcohol. This isn't to say how little or how much, but just to say that they have experienced alcohol in their lives. And as you can see, 50% at the eighth grade level in Minnesota, which I don't think is a real radical state, just an average America, 50% at the eighth grade level, 95% at the 12th grade level. So this is a common experience for our young people, and it's a fairly common experience for the American public, of which at least 75% have chosen to use alcohol. And that's neither good nor bad. It's just saying that 75% of them have chosen to do that. 25% have not, for whatever reason, chosen to do so. Okay, where do we go after being attracted? In my case, it was a matter of getting to know alcohol, spending some time together with alcohol, in the same way that I would spend some time together with a gal I wanted to get to know better. And maybe that meant going out to the movies, or maybe that meant having a walk together, or taking some time to be together in some kind of an activity. And when we were involved in that kind of being together, I felt very good. And I had a lot of good feelings. And I felt better about myself. And I felt a little more free. And isn't that true in our relationships with people? And it's also true of our relationship with alcohol when we look at that. Not only do we spend time together, but we also, in developing those good feelings, we find out what is dependable and how trustworthy and dependable we are. And maybe in terms of courtship, we find out one's strengths and weaknesses. With alcohol in my life, it was very dependable. It did what I wanted it to do. It made me feel good. It gave me a sense of well-being, a sense of escape, if that's what I wanted to do, or just a good time. And it worked. Just like when I would be dating a gal, that too had an element of dependability about it. And as our relationship developed, I could begin to count on that. And then to go beyond just the spending time together part of our relationship, I think there's a twist, there's a turn that develops here. And that is, and it's the same twist or turn that happens in a courtship, I believe, or dating. And that is, you start to make time. You go from just spending time together to making time together, making time for each other, thinking about each other, being preoccupied, being caught up in a relationship, being caught up in the other one. So it is with alcohol. So we start to plan our day or our work or our recreation around the drug, like we plan our activities around the man or woman in our life. Or if you have children, you know what that's like. You have to plan your life with those children in mind. So it is with addiction. We become caught up in it so that it starts to shape our living and our focus. That, I believe, is a crucial phase. That turn, that new twist from just spending time together to making time. And it leads into the next phase of that courting and that relationship building. And that we often think of as engagement. That time when a couple is looking at their relationship and trying to evaluate it and size it up and asking some hard questions like what does the future hold for us, and how well do we get along, and do we want to take this a step further in terms of commitment, in terms of making what we share together a way of life. Boy, that's a big step. But we've already got our foot in the door. From making time for each other, now we're talking about making a way of life with one another. And that's finally I came to that kind of understanding with alcohol. To look forward to that time together, whether that was at a social event or a bar, or sitting at home watching TV. And it is no different when we think about our social relationships. And now engagement is finally saying, you know, I want this to continue. I want this relationship to go on. I want this way of life to be ours or to be mine. And so that leads us just a step further down the road to marriage, which really is simply affirming what happens in the engagement, in the committing phase, until death do us part. One cannot imagine life without the other person. That's one way of looking at that. I just can't imagine life without this other person. I just can't imagine life without alcohol. That for me was kind of the clincher. That was putting the ring on the finger. That told me a lot about my state of well-being. And it wasn't very well. Maybe I could, trying to be aware of the time here, maybe I could just say a little bit more about that. When I was in seminary, I managed to get through college. I managed to graduate and get a degree, and that was a degree in psychology. And I don't know if I really earned it or not, but anyway, the school thought I did, and I completed what I had to complete, and I went on to seminary. But at seminary, I wasn't able to really pull things off very well. I wasn't completing my class assignments. I wasn't very dependable. I'd get things half done, and you know, I was good at starting things. I was very poor at finishing them. Or if I didn't feel I could do something well enough, I just simply didn't do it at all. I got to the point where where personal relationships were at a pretty low ebb. Because of my own dishonesty with the people around me, I got to a point where I simply didn't want to face them, knowing that I hadn't been very square with them, that I'd tried in maybe small and big ways to take advantage of them, and that was hard to live with. I hadn't been very honest with myself. And so it became hard to even like myself. At one point, I can remember even becoming suicidal. There's a pillar, there's a concrete pillar on I-94 that goes between St. Paul and Minneapolis. And for a long time, every day as I commuted to class, I looked at that pillar. That was my pillar. That pillar had my name on it. And it looked, as I got more and more depressed and life looked bleaker and bleaker, that pillar looked better and better each day. And you know, that's frightening to think about. But it is a subtle process. You don't get there overnight. You don't go from just getting acquainted to getting married, at least hopefully not. It takes some time, and it's not something that I think is always a conscious process. It is something that you are caught up in. And to say those words, "until death do us part," I think gives us a sense of the seriousness of what's taking place. So I was, as far as I was concerned, alcohol had really nothing to do with my problems. That's what I thought. Also, I thought that it would be no problem to let go of it. And I could say that. I could verbalize that. But I couldn't do it. I wasn't willing to do it. And when I started to take a closer look at that, those words, "until death do us part," came back again. That's how much it meant to me. It was that much an integral part of my being, you might say. And I simply couldn't see my life any other way. Now that's what addiction does. That's the kind of hold that addiction has on a person. But there are good marriages and there are bad marriages. And as my life went on, the kinds of consequences I continued to have harmful consequences in my life. I continued to fail in school. I continued to have poor relationships with people, not getting anything out of the relationships that I had with people. I continued to kind of drift along, letting the world determine my life instead of having some sort of responsibility for my actions. It was easy for me to blame my poor performance in school on the administration or the teacher or the textbook, anybody but Tom. It was easy for me to be a skeptic and tell the world all the things that was wrong with it, and never looking at my own inventory or my own defects. And when those kinds of harmful consequences keep building up, you get to a point where you can no longer imagine life with alcohol. You catch the double, or you catch the flip-flop in there. With marriage, one cannot imagine life without alcohol. And finally, you get to the point where you can no longer imagine or without alcohol, and now you can't imagine life with it. You know, it's kind of like sick and tired of being sick and tired. You get to that point. And then you need a separation. And that's where divorce comes in. And that's where I had to say, yeah, I've had enough. I'm willing to say that there needs to be a divorce here. There needs to be an end, an ending to this relationship, this to alcohol in my my life. The two simply can't get along together. And the longer they are together, the more destruction and stress and all kinds of things that are not upbuilding happen. Now, I've said this in a very short time, and I haven't elaborated too much, but I hope maybe you've gotten a little bit of a taste, or some familiarity with where I'm, how addiction is a subtle, growing kind of process. I didn't start my life out to be an alcoholic. When I was a little boy, I didn't grow up saying, geez, when I get older, I want to be a drunk. And I didn't even say that when I was using drugs and alcohol. I mean, that wasn't a goal for me. That wasn't something that I seriously considered. It was something that happened. And I suppose a lot of them, I hear a lot of misunderstanding about that. How can people let that happen to them? As though they were totally responsible and in control and had planned it all out. I have not found that to be the case. But it is kind of like falling in love and getting married and finding out that you've got a pretty terrible situation, and finally the necessity of divorce for your own well-being. I guess the good news that I see in all of this, and it's taken me a while to see it, you can look at it two ways, perhaps. The statistics show us that 1 out of 10 will become addicted at some time in their life. 1 out of 10. Well, or you can look at it this way. 90% of the people are able to live with alcohol. 90%, that's not bad. But 10% are not. For a combination of things, for spiritual, for physical, for emotional, for mental reasons, this drug just plays havoc with their life. Another thing that's interesting too, and I think this is some good news, that 1 in 4 choose to abstain. 25% of our population simply could care less. It evidently isn't attracting for them. And so they don't. Of their own choosing, they just simply don't use, which is fine. I'm comfortable with that. Maybe the other 75% aren't real comfortable with that. and that creates some problems. But I think that there's some good news there. So it isn't all dismal and black. There is some hope. And certainly the growth of Alcoholics Anonymous in America and around the world has given us a real concrete sign of light in the darkness. Well, I could say much more, but I think at this time I'm probably just going to throw it out and see what kinds of concerns or clarification you might bring forward. Right, that's very important. Responsible usage. Not only that, but by teaching them responsible usage, it takes a little of the drama out of it. The thrill is no longer there. I mean, if you stop to think about it, there really is a lot. Especially if you are a teenager, you're already doing something that's illegal. And all the little games that we play with that, from hiding our stash to making the connection to finding a place to get high, and there's a lot of thrill there, just beyond even using the drug itself.
Do you consider yourself now over your problem?
No, I don't consider myself over it. It is an illness that I'm living with. It's an illness that right now is arrested kind of like, you know, diabetes can be arrested. But what I have is it's primary in my life. It comes first. If I were to go back to using, I would go right back to being just as messed up emotionally and spiritually and physically and mentally as I was before. As a matter of fact, if you try to do any kind of marriage counseling or any kind of counseling with a chemically dependent person, you're not going to get anywhere, because there's something that's more primary than the marital problems, more primary than the job problem, more primary than the friendship problem. And that's the, you need to look at the alcoholism or drug dependency. Once that's checked out, once that's arrested, then the other things can be dealt with. But as it says here, I've got a primary illness. It's progressive. It'll only get worse. It won't get better. It'll only get worse. It's chronic. It's for life. And if it's not dealt with, it is terminal. It will kill. What do we preserve things in? Alcohol. You know, it has a lot of good purposes, but it's also a very toxic, powerful chemical.
Yeah, I got a couple friends who are still on alcohol treatment. I don't know if you've been through it.
Mm-hmm.
But I've learned a lot about alcoholism in the last few months, and that one of the things is that alcoholism is a disease. It's not something you choose to do or choose to be or not to be.
Right.
And that they say that right now there's a best theory to have is that there's a drug that is produced in your body. Certain people have it and certain people don't. 10% of people do. And when you drink alcohol, then that chemical is produced, and it's just like when you take heroin, it's so addictive. And that's why you get addicted to it. And I was in family. The hardest thing about for parents to understand about their kids when they were alcoholics is that it wasn't anything that caused them to be an alcoholic. The kids are saying, why are you an alcoholic? Why do you do this? Why do you drink? And there's no reason except for the first a lot of them, except for the fact that they have this drug and they become addicted to it. And some parents left and they still don't understand that fact. And so it's not something you choose to do. I mean, it's a disease, a physical disease, and not a mental disease. I think that's how frustrating my friends have never had.
And I probably spent the first 2 years of my sobriety struggling with that, you know, the whys and the how comes and the why me's. You know, why me, Lord? You know.
Well, you certainly haven't got rid of it or helped yourself by your own bootstraps, so to speak.
I have or haven't?
You have not.
Right, right.
In other words, as she said, is a chemical situation in your body where once you have that addiction, that it becomes the point where you admit that I am an alcoholic. An addiction, that's, I have a tendency towards it, I like it, but you, at one point in time, have to say to yourself and to all the world, really, I am an alcoholic, period.
Mm-hmm.
You're publishing it, so to speak, not if you don't go out and say, I'm an alcoholic on the street, but you don't deny at all that you're an alcoholic. And that's number one step in trying to cure it. And then after that, you can't just say, well, now I'm going to quit. That's kind of impossible. You have to have help from a lot of people that understand it the same way you do. And many people, they're trying to get over this. And they're best able to go to meetings every day or every other day or at least that often, maybe sometimes once a day, but others just to talk about the problem and admit to each other they are an alcoholic. it's really something you can't very well just change yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Now, maybe a lot of other people are addicted in a sense, they don't have this chemical attraction that they have no control over and can drink an awful lot more and not be in the same sense an alcoholic. But if you have that chemical attraction, you just don't say, I'm not going to have it today. You just go get it.
Yeah.
Or you have to go to, you can take all the liquor out of the house and tie it. People get out somehow and get it.
Where there's a will, there's a way.
Right. And you don't say, I'll wait till 10 o'clock and have it. I'm going to right now. And when I quit.
Okay, in the back.
What should one do if one knows an alcoholic? And one cares about this person?
Well, I there's two ways I can address that. One is maybe... To be honest with them, especially in terms of being responsible for the consequences in their life. You know, if they wreck the car because of drinking, don't whitewash that. Address that as not it's not a traffic problem. You know, if you are out at midnight. And you had you know 0.2 ounces of alcohol in your blood, you know that's an alcohol problem. That's not a traffic problem. It's not a mechanical problem that the car didn't do what it was supposed to do. We need to be upfront about that, and not let people off the hook, you might say, for those consequences. The other thing, though, that comes into play is who says that and how significant you are in the person's life. You know, if you know, as an adolescent, if my mother told me something like that, I could probably blow it off and not take it seriously. If another 17-year-old told me that, would be a little different story. Or maybe my best friend, or somebody that I respected and was significant and meaningful in my life at that point. And the obvious people may not be. Like my mom and dad may not be the most significant people. And then again, they may, depending on the relationship. But even if you aren't significant, I think just being concerned for another human being, we can honestly share with them our concern about what's happening in their life, and how we see that being connected to alcohol, if it is connected, or to drug abuse.
There's a real good book that helps people that have people in their life that are involved with alcoholism. It's called The Boo Saddle. And there's also an organization that's kind of the counterpart to Alcoholics Anonymous called Al-Anon. And it teaches you how to work on yourself. And it's not an organization to help you cure the alcoholic. That can't be done. But it helps you, you know, deal with the insanity and alcoholism and helps you get yourself together and in fact help them understand what place they're at.
Yeah, that is a good book. The Booze Battle. It's very readable too, I might say.
The Booze Battle.
The Booze Battle. It's a paperback.
I know.
Huh?
Andrew Rice.
Andrew Rice is the author.
There's another thing in this that you might think is wrong, and that is if someone is an alcoholic and a neighbor, for example, wants to help and they know that this person has an alcohol problem or is an alcoholic, but they're trying to help them out to keep it hush-hush, they will take care of their children or they'll do this other chore for them and so forth, and they become an enabler. An enabler actually is doing more harm. So you might say, as a Christian, you want to help this person, but to do these things for them just makes the situation worse, because then that alcoholics, well, I'm getting along fine now because even though I have a problem, I'm getting my problem solved and my work done. So to help them, as you might say a Christian person would want to do, actually is defeating the purpose of getting them to the real point of admitting that they're an alcoholic and in this other type of Al-Anon or mm-hmm. Alcoholics Anonymous, and that sort of constant association with others who have the same disease. So that their little conflict there, what is the right thing to do?
Yeah, Al-Anon will teach you how to detach yourself from the denial process of the illness of alcoholism, and it'll help you to not be an enabler like this gentleman was saying, and I guess that's another thing I would say. You may not be able to do anything for the person themselves. You can do something for yourself, and that is to attend Al-Anon. And that speaks to the family illness. I don't say this to be arrogant or boastful or anything, but sometimes the family is just as sick or more sick than the alcoholic, which is just kind of mind-boggling when you get into it. But that's often the case. Our treatment system, right now, our treatment centers should really have a family treatment center as well as a center for the patient themselves.
Well, they do.
Well, I know, but I have yet to see a treatment center that has 4 weeks of inpatient care for the family. Maybe there is one. Maybe there is one. There are some that have a week for family. Some have 3 days for family. There's some tensions too. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous says you let the person come to that decision themselves. The treatment center folks, like Johnson Institute, for example, say you can intervene in the process and directly step into this person's life and get some help for them and force the issue. And sometimes that's called raising the bottom. Instead of letting a person hit bottom, you raise the bottom a little quicker so they can see what's happening, and then they can respond so they don't have to go that far down. They can do something with their life before that point. I don't know about intervention. I know about treatment centers. Most treatment centers in the first 2 years have about, if it's a good center, it has about a 70% success rate. In other words, the person will stay sober. 70% of the patients stay sober within the first 2 years. You know, some places have a higher percentage. Some have 80%. But that's something you ought to ask if you're looking at a treatment center, because they all keep the data on that kind of thing. They know what their success, their sobriety rate during the first 2 years is, if they're a good center. Just like, you know, you would ask your doctor those kinds of questions if you had cancer or some other illness. You'd want to know what's the risk involved in this surgery.
I was wondering, from a pastor's point of view, how has the spirituality aspect of the 12-step program of AA helped you?
Completely transformed my life.
Do you want to explain?
You would ask that. It's hard to explain it. Maybe the simplest way is...
Can I ask one other question, kind of a pre-listener? Were you spiritually involved or religious before you got into AA? And how has that changed your thought of spirituality?
Okay. I was in my second year at seminary when somebody showed some care about what was happening to my life. My life was just slowly going down the tubes, and I was on my way of flunking out of seminary. Okay, so that was sort of the intervention in my life, the raising of the bottom. The person said, hey, I care about what's happening to you. And I was desperate enough to where I reached out to that person. and said, "Yeah, I'm pretty concerned too. And will you struggle with me through this kind of thing?" Well, and it took about 6 months of just back and forth. And 1 minute me saying, "No, there's nothing wrong with my life," and me, and the next minute saying, "I just want to drop out of school and forget it all, and let's just call it quits." And just back and forth, from one day being paranoid to the next day being very optimistic.
Well, in all my years, I've known all kinds of different kind of alcoholics. They're not all alike.
No, they're not.
And that's something you can acquire a taste for.
Yeah, I guess I never really acquired much of a taste for alcohol beyond what it did, what it made me feel. I still, to this day, don't care for the taste. But I dearly...
Some alcoholics I've known has acquired a taste.
Yeah, yeah.
And they weren't teenagers either.
No. I dearly love the feeling, though. Some people have even called this a feeling illness.
Mm-hmm. See? But there's a lot of different kind of alcoholics. Some will never admit they're one.
Right, yeah.
Some never get well, either.
Huh?
They'll never get well if they're...
No. But they never admit
it. They're just dead.
Yeah. Yeah, I try to stay away from labeling, I guess. Here's an A alcoholic, here's a B, here's a C. I try to stay away. The bottom line is do I have control of my life? Am I in control? Do I have power or am I powerless, and is my life unmanageable? In effect, my spirituality was that I was powerful, I was in control, and God was somewhere off in a fog, you might say.
Even though I was in seminary,
that's right. And well, what's the difference really, whether you're in seminary or whether you're in nursery school?
And then.
Okay, and so as I started to question my powerfulness and my manageability about alcohol, I also looked at some other areas in my life. And how controlling was I? How trusting was I? How depending was I? I wasn't very depending. I wasn't very trustworthy. And then you start to ask, well, how does God fit into all of this? Can he be the powerful one? Can he be the one who is trustworthy? Can he be the one who's the good manager, the good shepherd? And that's when things really started to happen for me. And then I understood sin not as morality or not as a lot of other things, but sin was a powerful force in my life, and it was keeping me from. It was kind of like a big roadblock, and I couldn't overcome it on my own. And that's when I had that's when I got down on my knees and was brought to my knees, you might say. Yeah, the strength is. The strength is simply in is the strength is in the weakness. As contradictory as that sounds, I am, as Paul says, God is strongest in me when I admit my weakness. Is another way. Did you have in the bib overalls? Did you have your hand up? No. Okay.
Say a person goes. I've heard many people go through this treatment center. They're sober a little while, and then they go back to this treatment center. Is there any advantage to it, or are they just using that as a crutch? What?
It can be used as a crutch.
Well, that's the way it sounded. This person was.
But I wouldn't let that bother me. I wouldn't let that bother me. If he's using it as a crutch, so what? It's a good crutch. Maybe
it's
something.
Right.
Maybe something will happen. I guess I don't get too upset about that. I mean, I've talked to people who have been through treatment 10 and 12 times.
Well, that's what I was wondering, what the object really
right now, there is some talk right now that with Blue Cross and some of the insurance companies going to a different system of paying insurance. There is some talk now that you should only go through treatment once, and then after that, the insurance company won't pay for the treatment. You know, and what they're saving some bucks that way, but there's more to it than that. It's also a matter of saying, you know, are we enabling, is the insurance company enabling the person to carry on irresponsibly by treating him a third, a fourth, a fifth time?
Well, I think that they treat the center, of course, the support, but then that, what is the recovery? I think that is the most important if they don't guide him properly.
Okay. And let us keep in mind that any treatment center is only 10% of the treatment. 10% of the treatment.
Well, that's what I
think. Alcoholics Anonymous or some other support group is the 90%. You know, that's where the rest of the person's recovery will take place.
I don't like the idea that insurance companies would say once is all you're good for. It's like saying, you have cancer, we'll pay for one shot of chemotherapy, and it doesn't
feel well. Yeah, see, and it may be getting to that point. I mean, it's frightening to think about it. But maybe part of it is, you know, maybe they are kind of playing into the denial that it is an illness. That could be.
Yeah.
But it's in sort of a gray area, you know, sort of between a physical and mental illness, yeah, somewhere in there.
I think maybe times these people that go to the treatment center for a week or two and get tried out, and you go to all electric classes and group therapy things, then think, well, now I got to, I know what to do, I'll go to this meeting and that meeting, but they get a feeling now, I'm an alcoholic, yes, but I know how to handle it now. I found the solution, so before long, they are falling away on these, getting together group therapies and all the things that they really need to maintain. And then first, you know, slips in there back in there. And it doesn't take more than a few drops if you're chemically addicted or chemically an alcoholic before you're out of control completely again. So it's really the person's responsibility, you know, the fact that they weren't shown, for the most part, in most good therapy groups, how to approach the problem, but they... Oh. Their lacks in the...
And when we say that it is a progressive illness, okay, I've been sober 7 years. If I were to start using today, again, it would be just like I had never been sober. It would be just as though I had been drinking during those 7 years. I would pick up right at that point, which is, you know, you talk about cunning, baffling, and powerful. That's very, very cunning, baffling, and powerful. So I guess the longer I'm sober, the more precious the treasure of sobriety becomes, and the more danger is involved in falling back. And then to address spirituality again, through AA and the 12 steps, I guess I've learned to appreciate daily baptism. What is daily baptism but dying and rising? Falling, and it's saying, I am powerless, and my life is unmanageable, Lord. And then trusting the power and the promise of a gracious God for powerless, unmanageable people. It's just completely, you know, given me a new understanding of daily baptism in that way.
You compared the initial stages of alcoholism, the crucial stages you mentioned, with love addiction.
Love and addiction, yeah.
I see. And you also mentioned about the conversion that happens where the alcohol becomes the focal point of the dependent person. Now, was this the same thing true in love and addiction? As far as, you know, when does a love become hurtful?
Okay. Yeah. I was afraid you might ask something like that, or somebody would. I'm speaking of love. When I talk about love and addiction here, I'm speaking of love in a very poor sense. You know what I mean? I'm not talking about what I think of as true love. So I'm not saying that all love is pathological. Okay, I'm not saying all love is sick. But it can become sick. It can become ill. And it can turn in on itself and become destructive. Just like addiction. Just like alcohol can turn in on a person and become destructive. But it doesn't have to. You know, 90% are doing just fine. It's the 10% who struggle with what addiction means. And why is their drinking experience different than the 90? And how do you understand? How do you understand that? You know, how come these other 9 folks over here are doing just fine, and I seem to be out of control? How come they don't have blackouts like I've got blackouts? And how come, you know, they're not dependable on their jobs? Like, how come they're honest and it seems to work for them, and I'm dishonest and just getting deeper and deeper in my own lies?
I'm not sure about the 90% being fine.
Well, now there's a big gap between addiction and healthy, responsible usage. I mean,
some of them get headaches, I think.
Yeah. But there's another area, and we haven't even talked about that, and it would take another hour to do so, and that's the problem drinker. That's different. I'm not a problem drinker. See, what I've got is a terminal illness. I mean, it's a chronic progressive illness, and it's not reversible. With a problem drinker, you can take, it's possible to make some amends, to make a correction in the way you're using. Instead of having 3 drinks, so maybe you have 1 drink per hour. Okay? You know, I wouldn't try that. See, I won't try that. I know better.
Then it could occur at any age if providing you didn't drink earlier and you started.
Yeah, it can happen at any age. I know a 10-year-old who's in AA. That's the youngest I know, is a 10-year-old. There are younger.
Older,
sure. Well, yeah, older people, it's the same. We're in the senior citizen high-rises in Minneapolis, as well as other cities. Terrible problem among the elderly. Just terrible. And growing.
Is it because of their
family? Why? I don't know why. I mean, I'm sure there's several factors. I mean, loneliness would be a factor, among other things. You know, self-esteem would be a factor.
I think they have too much idle time.
And that might be a factor.
They have something to do to pick up their interest. But usually in a retirement settlement, they have all kinds of activities. You know, a lot of houses.
Yeah. I'm aware of the time, and we've just got a minute or two left, so.
I'd like to say something about Sun City, because we live in Sun City West.
Uh huh.
And it's not because they have more idle time that people in Sun City West are more active than more any other retirement place in the world that I can think of. It's very active. You think they just sit around their chairs and rocking, and that's not the case at all.
It may be that the lifestyle is a little more progressive there, and drinking among the elderly would be more acceptable, whereas in other places they're expected to be, you know, just sit there and rock in their rocking chairs and not go out drinking and, you know, and the question about, you know, alcoholism can set in on any age. Even if you started drinking at 80, you know, if you were an alcoholic, you could start
have that
then.
In your blood.
Maybe
you
won't. Maybe
you
just have 10% of the
Yeah.
It's just like diabetes
and
something they hadn't experienced it before.
There are several reasons why elderly tend to become alcoholic in their later parts of their life. One is that, you know, the body metabolism changes, and the rate that they break down alcohol changes. Also, elderlies have a lot of, you know, pains in it, and it becomes a process of self-medicating.
That's right.
And
yeah.
Also, they're taking other drugs that potentiates the effects of alcohol. So they go through the progression of alcoholism much more appropriate. Yeah. So.
I think Dad would go. He should have some right thing. Not TV. Liquor just cures everything. Anything comes up to have time.
Yeah.
Good or bad, yeah, celebrate.
Okay, I'd like to close with these thoughts, and that is that in spite of me being an addicted person, in spite of my alcoholism, I can continue to give thanks to God for alcohol. That too is a gift of His creation. In my life, it has taken some other turns. But that doesn't mean that it's an evil or wicked substance. But it can be abused, and like any gift. And so on that note, I thank you for coming and participating.
Thank you.